Thank you for joining me. I'm sitting in for George Norrie tonight, and I'll be back again tomorrow night. Why don't you go check out what we've got going on over at the Coast to Coast AM website. DB Cooper code finally cracked. Well, researchers trying to solve the infamous DB Cooper case believe that they have cracked a code contained in one of the notorious skyjacker's letters. There's a news article up about that. And the Grand Warlock of Mexico predicts no war with North Korea for 2018. Sorcery stoppers have been formed in India. A phantom bike has been spotted in Malaysia. And a psychic shop in the UK is under fire for offering classes to kids. You can find information about that by visiting coasttocoastam.com. And to keep up with what George is doing, remember, you can check out the events page because there's a special event coming up in the Eat and Greet Luncheons at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California, coming up Tuesday, February 13th. The first luncheon of 2018 and the next in the Eat and Greet Luncheon series. Special guest is Steve Cates, Dr. Sky. You can learn about the science of astronomy, Q&A, where you bring your questions about our skies and the universe. You can meet and greet with George Norrie, Dr. Sky, and Tom Danheiser. There's contests and prize giveaways, great food, and a lot of fun. Don't miss out. You can email for information, lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. That's lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break and come back again, continue talking with Adam Frank, our guest, and we'll take your phone calls. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to Coast AM. We're back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Adam Frank is my guest. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, sitting in for George Norrie. Adam, you've got a new book that's going to be coming out, what is that, in June this year?
Yep.
And what's the book that you're going to be releasing now?
It's called Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. And, you know, the whole book is really about planets and projects of civilization. Because that's what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years. We've been building this amazing project of civilization. And, you know, what I'm looking at in the book is the way that there are probably, you know, kind of generic things that happen to a planet when you get a, you know, an energy-intensive, you know, high-tech civilization.
What keeps you so fascinated about this field and drive to just try to continually understand it? I mean, it seems, again, you're theoretical in a lot of the sense, and some of this is just really solid guesswork. But what keeps you, you know, intrigued enough to just want to keep plowing ahead and doing more and more on this?
Well, you know, first of all, the universe is just so amazing, right? I mean, that's the thing for me is that, like, you know, just an ant colony, you know, you're walking along the street and seeing ants and, you know, doing their business. The world, every part of the world is amazing. You know, the fact that the sky is blue, the seasons, the way the seasons change. And what science, you know, the reason I call myself an evangelist of science is just to show people how amazing it is, this amazing thing we've done called science, this way of, you know, sort of getting into a dialogue with the world, you know, that we can ask it questions and we know how to listen to its answers, that it's just, it never fails to be remarkable, whether, you know, I'm learning something new about how DNA works or in my own field, you know, every week we have speakers come in and talk about, tell us something new about their research. And like every week I'm like, wow, you know, black holes, you know, new exoplanets that we found. It just really keeps me awake. You know,
what is some of the new news that you're hearing that really is you find fascinating and exciting? And again, how do you start to differentiate between the theoretic science of what they're discussing and the actual hands-on science that we can prove some of these theories to back them?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's just be careful when we talk about theory, right? Theoretical, because, you know, in science, we have when we talk about theoretical, there's a difference in science between sort of a theory, you know, sort of like, you know, who killed Mr. Mudd, you know, last week, right? You know, that's a theory with a small t, you know. But big, we have big theories, theories like, you know, theory of electromagnetism, theory of quantum mechanics. And we'll use the word theory there, but there's so, that is something that is, like, say, electromagnetism. We call it a theory, but it's backed by, you know, literally 150 years of one experiment after another. So, you know, for us, often a theory is a body of knowledge that has a lot of backing, and then we can use to extend, you know, to go further. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book. I'm trying to only use science we understand and just step it a little bit farther, push it out a little bit farther to understand how an exo-civilization could impact its planet. So I'm really, you know, what science gives us is like guardrails for thinking about things. So even if we're pushing past where we have data, those guardrails at least tell us what is feasible or what is possible. So it's different from writing a science fiction story. So, you know, so in that way, I think, you know, science can really, even if we're going past where the data is, if we're careful, we can at least see what's feasible, what the universe might allow. So that's how I distinguish between the two. But when your question about what's new and interesting, I mean, those gravity waves that we discovered, that you know, the kilonova, we're actually seeing distortions in space and time from, you know, huge titanic events like two black holes merging that are literally, you know, halfway across the universe.
How is that even possible for two black holes to merge? You would think that they would almost repel each other.
Yeah, no, what happens because of the gravity. The gravity is so strong. These kinds of objects are two massive stars that were probably born together. You know, they were born as a, what we call a binary star, and they lived their whole lives, and when they died, they each one became a black hole, but they were still orbiting each other. So, you know, a black hole is like a stellar corpse in some sense. And so, you know, these two black holes stayed orbiting each other, but because of what Einstein gave us, we know that that they are constantly, their orbits are always going to be bleeding some energy out into space in what we call gravity waves, and that will draw the two black holes together. Their orbit will shrink until they eventually merge in a, you know, event that is, you know, so powerful, is the amount of energy in it is just psychotic. And we've now learned to be able to feel, in some sense, with our instruments, the ripples in space-time, the distortion in space-time from this event that, like I said, happened halfway across the universe. And Einstein...
Now, what does that mean when you say ripples in space-time? How is that a measurable thing for us? You know,
we usually think of space as kind of being like empty, and we just sort of move through it, you know, and time is just this sort of, you know, river that's, you know, just flowing along. But what Einstein showed us, you know, 100 years ago was that actually... You know, space is not an empty stage. It's actually a player in physics. It's actually distortable. It can be stretched and bent. And actually, we don't think about space alone anymore. We think of space and time being the, you know, part of a whole. Just like we think of matter and energy being, you know, the part of different parts of the same thing. Space and time have to be welded together. And so what we've learned is that space and time can be stretched and distorted, and that it gets stretched and distorted by matter. So even right now, where you're sitting right now, actually space and time are actually pulled a little bit towards you. Any matter distorts space. And a black hole is just a huge amount of matter in a very small space. So it has a huge distortion of space and time. And when something really violent happens, then it sends out ripples. Just like if you took a sheet, you know, quickly, you know, flick a sheet, you see a little wave ripple through it, or when you drop a stone on a pond, there's a ripple that goes along. Actually, space and time itself will ripple, and it will head outward. And what we do, we've developed incredibly sensitive instruments to be able to detect that ripple, that distortion in space and time from these distant events.
And when you're hearing all these great new theories and these great new aspects of science that people are bringing, is there ever one that they bring out to these symposiums, when they start to talk about it or they unleash it on you, you just say, this is impossible. You know, do you guys still bat heads over some of these different aspects?
Oh, yeah, no,
aspects?
Scientists, we argue all the time. I mean, that's the thing that people really need to understand. Scientists, we make our living by showing other people are wrong, right? You know, agreeing with each other is not something we like to do. So, you know, and that's what makes science so amazing, is the adversarial kind of, that's what gives it, that's what, how we make the progress that we make. So, yeah, when somebody... So the claims of, say, when people first thought they started to see gravity waves, there were people in the 60s who thought they'd built instruments to see gravity waves. And it was like, nope, sorry. You know, when we went through it in detail, it's like, that's not a gravity wave. That's just the Earth shaking from a truck 50 miles away, right? So, you know, when any time anybody comes with a, you know, really new and you know, big claim, it gets beaten. You know, everybody, you know, you got to expect to get bloodied if you're going to come and say something really, you know, really radical.
But I got to guess that's part of the excitement of doing this, right, is by shaking people's paradigms, bringing a new thought or bringing a different twist on an original thought and seeing where it goes from there.
Oh, God, absolutely. And that's the thing. And because, you know, it's part of the whole process is the data, is having nature speak to us. You know, we found that's what we discovered with science 400 years ago. We found this way to sort of talk to nature where nature can talk back. Can, you know, we can ask questions of nature, and we figured out how to get responses from it. And so when you get that link between a new idea and data that backs it up, and it's really something, you know, that you weren't expecting, which is what happened with the exoplanets, right? I mean, you know, when I started in astronomy, there were no planets. There were other than the ones in our solar system. We didn't know about any other planets. People had lots of claims. Lots of careers were ended by people claiming to have discovered an exoplanet and then having that claim, you know, be demolished. So when in 1996, when that first claim was made, and it was a planet that looked nothing like our solar system. It was a Jupiter-sized giant planet that was closer to its star than Mercury is to the sun. Nobody expected that, right? So, you know, that was one of those examples where nature just showed us how much more creative it was than our own imaginations.
Well, that's pretty exciting, isn't it?
It was. I remember that day. I remember, like, you know, looking at the, you know, getting the news, reading the paper, and being like, oh my God, this is real.
How did we not know that there were other exoplanets or you know, that just seems to boggle the mind with as far as science has come and the different beliefs of, you know, some of the greatest thinkers of our time. It would seem that that's been something that has been bandied about and discussed as a reality, not a probability, for longer than I would have thought.
You know, that's a really great question. And in the book, I went through the history of that. And so if you look at the history, you know, going back 2,000 years, you see people sort of arguing one way or the other, you know, like in the Middle Ages, people didn't think that there were other planets. And then in the mid-1800s, people thought there were. And then in the beginning of the 19th century, or the 20th century, there's a bunch of arguments came along, very good scientific arguments that said it should be very rare. Exoplanets should be very, very rare. And the problem with finding them is it takes enormous precision. Trying to see a planet around another star is the same thing as if you were in New York and you were looking at, you know, a baseball stadium in San Francisco, and you tried to detect a firefly next to one of those giant lights that lights up the field, right? You know, it's you know, it just requires such precision. We had to build such amazing instruments that could detect that teeny tiny signal of the planet next to its giant star. So that's why it took so long. People were working on it and they just didn't have the precision. And then in 1996 was the first time we developed the technology to actually see the trace of a planet orbiting another star.
And now we've got this new telescope, right, that's being put together that is supposed to see further back than we've ever seen before.
The James Webb telescope, is that the one that's going to replace the Hubble?
Right. Yeah. And this is supposed to see backwards. And this is intriguing to me. Please help me understand with my limited brain capacity. We're able to see back through time through this telescope, perhaps even to the beginning of all time, is what they're discussing with this. How does that work?
How does that work? Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing about the universe is that the speed of light is constant, right? It's fixed. It takes a certain amount of time for light to get from anything to you, right? So if you are looking at a lamp across, you know, the table, you're not seeing the lamp as it is. You're seeing the lamp as it was, like, you know, a nanosecond ago when the light left the lamp, right? I mean, so, you know, so the further away something is, the longer it's taken for the light to get to you. So that means, you know, the further something away is, you're looking at it a little bit further back in time. And once you get to, you know, astronomical distances, you're now starting to look hundreds of years back in time, thousands of years back in time. And then when you get to, like, cosmological scales, you're looking back hundreds of millions to billions of years back in time. So the things that we see at you know, in the far reaches of the universe, we're actually seeing very early into the history of the universe. We're seeing light that left 5 billion years ago, you know, light that left that object 5 billion years
ago. So we're seeing a ghosted image of what once was there or how it originated.
Well, yeah, right. We don't know. We're seeing the image of what it looked like back then. You know, it's probably still there, but, you know, we're not getting the light that it has just left is going to take another 5 billion years to reach us.
That seems strange to me, too, right? Because if you turn a flashlight on and turn it off, immediately it's devoid of light, so the darkness overtakes again. Yeah. If something that far out has been turned off that long, it seems like as it passes through time, the light would become more diminished as opposed to remaining steady, because there's perpetuating it, right?
Well, I mean, you know, like the star, like the sun's burning, right? So the sun is continually putting out light. So, but when I look at the sun, I'm looking at the light that left the surface of the sun, you know, a few minutes ago, you know, and so, you know, everything takes a certain amount of time to reach us. But, you know, it could still be burning. But what's amazing is, like, yeah, right, the light doesn't diminish. Like, an individual photon, which is a light particle, that will remain steady as it travels from one side of the universe to the other. But, you know, one of the reasons why this is so hard for us to grasp is light is so fast. Like, you know, light is literally the fastest thing in the universe. So, yeah, you turn a flashlight on, you turn it off, it seems to be instantaneous. But actually, it does, in fact, take a little bit of time for those photons to leave the, you know, to leave the element, the lighting element in the flashlight and make its way into your optic nerve.
So what good will this telescope do for us? What are we going to really be able to see and get a better understanding of, besides the fact that we're now looking back at life that probably no longer exists?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's going to do a bunch of different things. So the James Webb Telescope is going to be very good for, A, looking very far back, and what it's going to show us is the epoch of cosmic history when galaxies were first forming. So there was a time when there were no galaxies. There was no Milky Way. There was, you know, none of these beautiful spiral-shaped things we see. So it's really going to help us see about you know, a billion years or so right after, you know, a billion years or so after the Big Bang. And so we're going to see when the first construction of galaxies was happening. But it's also going to show us things that are close by, too. It's going to be very good for planet hunting. And in particular, I mean, this is the thing I really want people to understand, is that we are, I talked about this before, you know, we've gotten past the point of just being amazed that we're discovering exoplanets. We can now, or we're just starting, be able to characterize the atmospheres of those planets. We're able to actually see light that briefly passes through the atmosphere, and because we know how to do astronomy so well, we can kind of tell what the atmosphere is made of. And if we can do that, we're going to be able to start telling whether or not, potentially, whether there's life there. So we're going to start, it's called atmosphere characterization. And then with the James Webb Telescope and other new telescopes that we're building, we're starting to build on the ground, we're starting to build these huge 30-meter wide, you know, long, diameter telescopes. They're incredible, the size of them. And we're going to be able to actually have some data that can tell us whether or not there's gases in the atmosphere that are indicative that there's life there, that there's a biosphere there. So it's going to teach us things that are, you know, about that are in our galaxy, and it's also going to teach us things that are very distant.
So let me ask you a strange theoretical question then, okay? If we were to see through this telescope a planet that looks habitable, that looks to fit our realm of possibility for life to be there, and we decided to send a message to it, we would in fact then be sending a message backwards in time.
From their perspective, actually, so what will happen is, let's say it's 10 light years away. Let's say that planet is 10 light. We would send a message, and it would take 10 years for it to cross from us to them. So when they got it, they'd be getting a message from us that was sent 10 years, you know, in their past, right? So that's the thing. So we won't be sending it into the past. We'll be sending it into the future, but they will get if it was a picture of me, right? They'd see me as I was 10 years in the past. It would take 10 years to cross, right? And they'd see me. And that's one of the reasons why interstellar communications, I'm kind of skeptical of ever being able to build a real interstellar civilization, because, you know, of these huge distances. Not only is it takes, you know, so long to get there with conventional rockets, but even if you're just trying to pass messages back and forth, you know, if you're trying to talk with someone who's 1,000 light years away, you got to wait 1,000 years for your message to get to them, and then 1,000 years for their message to get, you know, their response to get back to you. So how can you have, like, really a civilization, you know, I mean, a galactic civilization, because of those communication times?
Yeah, that's where it starts to get really bizarre, right? The whole idea of communication back and forth. And are we sending it in a form that can be received? If they're not...
Yeah, right, right.
If they're not advanced enough to have radio frequency... or know how to tune into that, or if they're using a totally different style of communication, we may be sending messages back and forth nobody's able to pick up on, because we don't know how they're transporting these messages. We can send messages through light, correct? So that would be the fastest route to get these messages there.
But what kind of light should you look at? This has always been a question for people who do SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. You know, we've been using radio waves. That's what Frank Drake, when he started doing this back in 1959, because radio waves, they have very long wavelengths, and that means they can propagate for a long way. They don't get stuck by dust. They don't get absorbed very easily. So you can send radio waves, you know, almost across the entire galaxy without any absorption. But how do we know they're using radio waves? Maybe they're using lasers. Maybe they're using tight beam lasers. People are starting to think about that now. So it's always
Adam,
that question.
Frank, hold tight, Adam. We've got more to talk about, and we'll start taking your calls when we return on Coast to Coast AM. Always a pleasure to sit in for George Norrie. And if you'd like a chance to meet with George, got a couple of great opportunities coming up soon. Saturday, March 10th, George Norrie Live, The Invasion of Salt Lake City at the Gene Wagner Theater from 5 to 8 p.m. You can enjoy watching George Norrie interview ancient technology expert Jason Martell, UFO investigator and journalist Nick Pope, and the man who died three times and lived to talk about it, Danyon Brinkley. George Norrie will sing you a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in the Q&A with each guest. Don't miss out. Tickets are going fast. You can call the box office at 801-355-2787. That's 801-355-2787. Or visit artsaltlake.org. That's artsaltlake.org. And in April, at the Virginia G. Piper Theater, you can see George Norrie live in Scottsdale, Arizona, where you can enjoy George's interviews with spirit traveler Sonia Grace, astronomer and master of all things space, Dr. Sky, and they'll end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology today, Dr. Lynn Katai, you also have Melinda Leslie, Travis Walton, and John D'Souza. George Norrie will sing a few more songs with a live band, and you can take part in the Q&A with each one of the guests. Tickets are going fast for that as well. You can call the box office at 480-499-8587. That's 480-499-8587, or visit scottsdaleperformingarts.org. That's scottsdaleperformingarts.org. And get a chance to see what you hear on Coast to Coast all the time in a live venue and get a chance to meet the master himself. So check that out. You can get more information by visiting coasttocoastam.com and clicking under George's name to keep you up to date with what's going on. If you love the supernatural and the strange and paranormal, then check out my show Beyond the Darkness Monday through Friday. You can join us for 60 to 90 minutes of strange and bizarre talks as we talk with experts and guests and experiencers from around the world. You can find more information on our website at darknessradio.com. Stay tuned. Your calls are next here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And phone lines are starting to light up. You can give us a call and be a part of the show if you'd like to do that. Or you can simply email me, Dave at darknessradio.com. Adam Frank, our guest for the remainder of this hour, and then open phone lines for the last 2 hours of the show. Adam, are you ready to take a couple of phone calls?
Sure, that'd be great.
All right, why don't we start with Jason from Farmington, Missouri. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, you guys were talking about climate change earlier and global warming, and I want to tell you the reason why I think that, since I'm part of mainstream America, why a lot of people have problems with it. It was about 6 or 7 years ago that 100 scientists got caught fudging numbers, just a little bit, on their ice core samples and on some other data. Now, that's all fine and good because, you know, it wasn't by a lot that they were fudging the numbers, but they were fudging some of the numbers, and that's not right. Number two, you get people like Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio, you get them running the movement. People see them flying around their jets, and, you know, they're leaving a bigger carbon footprint than anybody. You know, and I'm not anti-science. You know, I believe that there is climate change, but that's just my theory.
Okay, hey, thanks, man. I appreciate that. You know,
yeah, thank you for calling in.
About the Al Gore thing. I mean, like, I really wish that Al Gore had not been the guy who became the face of, you know, climate science, because it just contributed to the whole politicization of this thing, you know? I mean, so then, you know, I mean, I wish there'd been somebody who was just like, you know, if Carl Sagan was still around, that would have been great. You know, somebody who was a scientist, who people respected as a scientist, to bring this message. So I hear you on that. You know, the thing about the fudging the numbers, that was what people were calling climate gate. And that, you know, people looked at it 10,000 times. They weren't fudging the numbers, right? I mean, and here's the thing about how you know that they weren't fudging the numbers. It's not just, there's not like five guys doing climate. There's thousands of people doing this, and everybody's doing their own work. And like I said, you know, people, we build our reputations on tearing each other apart. So the idea that these guys could somehow fudge their numbers and nobody else would have noticed, you know, it just, it wouldn't be possible, you know? So that whole idea that, that these guys had fudged their numbers, it came out of a bunch of stolen emails from, you know, some particular climate researchers. And, you know, the people who stole it, they took a bunch of those messages, pulled it out of context. Imagine you and I are having a, you know, a private conversation about somebody who we don't like, right? You know, and what we might say. And so, you know, they pulled a bunch of things out of those emails that were, you know, out of context. And they, you know, they were doing this deliberately. The people who stole those emails had a political agenda in mind. So, and, you know, there was a huge number of investigations of that. There was not a single scientific organization, you know, the world scientific organizations that are responsible for making sure that the integrity of the science, they all looked into it. There was nothing going on there. Now, it's not that there's not, like, still, you know, climate science is science. There's a lot of things what we don't know, a lot of places that we have questions about, but this basic idea that, you know, we understand that, you know, the climate is changing and it's changing because of us, that is just, it's been shown so many times. The medicines you use, a lot of the medicines you take from the doctor have not had gone through as rigorous a testing as the basic results of climate science have.
All right, let's go to our next call. We've got East of the Rockies, Joe from Long Island, New York. Joe, welcome to the show.
Great presentation. You know, I'd ask you about, you know, what's happening right now. We've got like a polar loop that's coming down further, or even to Florida. And that's understandable. There's more heat in the atmosphere from the open sea where there had been previously ice up in the polar region. But why are these systems stalling where previously they would flow through? And also with the Gulf Stream and that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, do you see changes there? And did you go back to Brazil and did you see changes there where they have to plant the coffee at higher altitudes than they did previously to get the coffee beans to work?
Well, there's a bunch of interesting, you asked a bunch of interesting questions. I mean, so right now, yeah, the East Coast is experiencing, you know, this incredible, you know, cold wave. And, you know, it's hard. This is the thing that climate scientists and any scientist has to really spend a lot of time is, what is the difference between natural variability? Because, you know, climate is a big system and there's going to be natural fluctuations and, you know, sort of long-term trends. And while there are some evidence that, you know, because we're dumping more energy into, that's really all climate change is, we're dumping more energy into the Earth's climate system. We're shaking it up, right? It's a big complicated machine and we're kicking it really hard. That because of that, you'll get even more severe winter storms. But we're not, the evidence for that is still a little shaky. The important thing to understand is that, you know, when you look at the number of times we're breaking heat records versus the number of times we're breaking cold records, overwhelmingly we're breaking more heat records. So having, you know, this cold snap, you know, doesn't at all change the basic conclusion that, you know, the planet is warming. I really like your question about the circulation around the Atlantic, right? The Gulf Stream, because, you know, the Gulf Stream is so important for human civilization, right? It carries warm water, you know, up along the East Coast and then over to Europe. And, you know, the Gulf Stream is just a particular circulation pattern of the last 10,000 years or so. It's just a particular kind of thing that sort of set up in this current climate state that we've had for the last 10,000 years or so. And it could change, you know, it could change. If we push the climate system hard enough, that river of warm water, you know, in the ocean will shift, and that would have huge consequences for human civilization. That's the kind of things, you know, I talk about. So that's really why you need, you know, why scientists have been saying, you know, raising the alarm bells, that if you push the system too hard, it's going to rearrange itself in ways that, you know, or could be, pretty detrimental to human civilization. So, and your point about the coffee beans is interesting, because, yeah, that's what I try and tell people. Climate change or climate science is not a house of cards. It's a mountain of boulders, you know, and each boulder is a result. And, you know, you can pull one boulder out and, you know, the thing will shift, but the mountain doesn't fall. It's climate science is not just atmospheric temperatures, it's rainfall patterns, it's where, you know, as you said, different kinds of agriculture, it's the bleaching of the ocean, the acidification of the ocean. There's so many different directions that we understand that the climate is changing that, you know, you can pick it, you can cherry pick one particular result and say, oh, I have a problem with that. But, you know, it doesn't change all the other results that we have that show us, and in, from biology to, you know, to oceanography, that show us the climate is changing.
You got to love that in Florida, they're being bombarded by frozen iguanas. Have you been reading about this?
I saw that. What is that?
You know, these poor iguanas, yeah, are just, it's so cold that they just stop moving and they freeze and then fall out of the trees and they're like laying around everywhere. And they're not dead. They're just kind of in this dormant state.
Yeah.
But wow, that is crazy, isn't it? Okay. Let's go west of the Rockies. Don in Salem, Oregon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. I had a math problem for you that's been bothering me.
Sure.
If the age of the universe is 13.8 billion years old and light year is 6.1 trillion miles, how long would it take to get to the center of the universe, and how many miles would it be? And I thank you.
Okay. You know, I mean, I'm not going to be able to do the conversion. It's late at night for me.
Hold on. Let me kick off a shoe and see if I can help you figure out the math.
but you did raise a really interesting point, which is about the center of the universe, right? And the cool idea and the totally freaky idea about cosmology is there is no center of the universe, right? Is that the universe, when we think about the Big Bang, you know, the image that comes to our head is of an explosion, like a firecracker. But in fact, what, you know, the way to think, and it's very hard to do this, about, you know, the birth of the universe is that it was everywhere. Like the universe was born everywhere. All of space, time, matter, energy, all appeared at once. So, you know, we now believe, you know, from the data we have, we believe that the universe is infinite. There's an infinite amount of space and time and matter. And it was born infinite, right? That's a really hard idea to wrap your mind around. What's happening, you know, we talk about the Big Bang, what we're talking about is that everything was packed tight together. The universe's density was much higher, its temperature was much higher, and then it started to expand. It started to stretch out and expand. But it was still infinite. It was infinite in the beginning, and it's going to be infinite forever. So I know that's very hard to wrap. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around, and I spend my life with it. But yeah, so there's no center.
Steve writes in from California. He's curious what your thoughts are on chemtrails. And do you believe that that is playing an effect into the global warming situation?
Well, chemtrails, you can imagine being a scientist, you know, that I'm not a fan of chemtrails, of the idea that there's anything, you know, being injected into chemtrails. So I'm going to have to say that, yeah, I don't believe that there are chemtrails. However, this is a remarkable result, is that the contrails, the vapor trails that jets form, which, you know, just the clouds, just the regular old physics of forming those, you know, sort of, you know, linear clouds behind jets, those actually have an effect on the climate. That is a remarkable thing that they're, you know, we have so much jet travel. Did you know that there's, at any one moment, there are a million human beings flying, you know, at any moment, there's like a million human beings 5 miles up in the air. That's an incredible thing about modern society. So we're doing so much jet travel that we are actually the vapor trails actually have an effect overall on the climate budget. It's pretty remarkable. It's not huge, but it's there.
First time caller, we have Joe in Florida calling in. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hello. How you doing, Adam? How you doing, Dave?
Good.
Good.
I mean, Dave, you had touched on a little bit why people are so, optimistic or against, you know, this new knowledge or seeking knowledge, you know, further knowledge of space and the creation of the universe. But I kind of, growing up, I'm 59 years old, and I've seen in the past where they took scientists, information like this. I mean, look, for instance, technology. Look at what they've done with the technology, with Snowden, what they've done with the people, you know, spying on their own people, chipping people. You see social media, how they actually get the younger generation to believe things and act upon what they see and what they hear. That's what scares me. I mean, exploring and understanding, we were created to with intelligence and understanding. I always want to understand, But what scares me is man himself. You know, getting this knowledge and what they do with this knowledge that they get. So I don't think we'll ever fulfill that understanding truly until we come right with ourselves and understand ourselves more and where we came from and where our sole purpose is as humanity, because we are unique. I don't care what anybody says. Right now, we are very unique, and many people have stated that. You know, we have the bang, and what's the chances of us, this creation, being like us with our genetics and everything else, that it would be so intricate. And so what would be the chances? Billion, trillion to one, that this would be the way we live and the way we're formed. So I just wanted your opinion on that. I think man would have to come right. It's nothing against learning. I love to learn, and I love to learn more. But it's what we do with that knowledge that kind of scares. I'm probably not the only one that scares a lot of people.
Yeah, hey, man, listen, I agree with you 100% on that. I mean, you know, there's science and then there's technology and there's how we, like I like to say, how we deploy technology. And, yeah, there's definitely, you know, the computer revolution, you know, is definitely brought some serious questions about the kind of civilization that we're building very rapidly. And it's always been that way with technology. You know what I mean? Well, the problem is always every time we invent a new technology, the first thing we do is use it to kill other people, right? So, you know, I hear you. And I think, you know, it's almost like a race that as people, you know, there's people who try to, when a new technology comes out, people trying to do good with it and try and make, you know, produce more human well-being, and other people who want to use it to be exploitive or just make things worse. So, you know, I think that's it's true that we should be concerned about that. And technology, the pace of technological change now is, you know, insane, right? It used to be, so I like video games. I play a lot of video games. And I remember, when I would play games that took place, you know, in the medieval era, everybody's fighting with swords, you know, like Assassin's Creed. Yeah, there was Assassin's Creed 2 and everybody's fighting with swords. Then Assassin's Creed 3 came out and it was, you know, a little bit later in time and everybody's still fighting with swords. So, you know, there's a long period of time there where, like, technology didn't change. You used the same tools your grandfather probably used. Now, right. My God, right? I grew up on phone. You know, when I was a kid, phones were something that was attached to the wall. And now, you know, how long is it going to be till I have a chip in my head with the phone? So it's like there are definitely ways in which the pace of technology is seriously challenging our ability to have a society where human well-being is first and foremost. But I'm an optimistic guy, you know? I also believe that this moment we're living in is really unique. I mean, you know, people may get very angry at me for saying climate change is true, but hey, that's the science, what can I say? But also, I think this is actually a huge opportunity for us. Climate change shows how powerful we've become. We changed the entire chemistry of a planet. Human beings are unique in this incredible power we have. And the question is, can we make it across? Can we see that we've done this amazing thing and then adjust, you know, make whatever changes we make to do? And I think this is what my book is about. I think this is kind of a generic transition. This is like our coming of age, right? When, you know, teenagers, right? You know, when you become a teenager, you get the car. You can, you know, if you're not smart, you're going to do something dumb with the car. If you can learn to be mature, you can do responsible things with the car. It makes your life better. We are cosmic teenagers. We are right at the moment, you know, where we're taking our final exam. That's what climate change is. Can we handle our own technology? Can we handle our own power and make wise choices with it? So, you know, totally hear what you're saying, but I'm fundamentally an optimistic guy. And I think, you know, I think we'll be able to figure it out.
I can't thank you enough for being our guest this evening, spending a little time here. We've got links up to your website and information on how people can find more about you. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
We've got a lot more coming up your way and open phone lines. We can discuss any topic you'd like to cover. Again, we'll do that for the remainder of tonight's show. I'll be back again tomorrow hosting with you. I'm your host for the evening. For Coast to Coast AM, I'm Dave Schrader.